This podcast is brought to you by On Track Studio.
This podcast addresses various mental health challenges, including topics such as suicide, addiction, eating disorders, depression, and anxiety. These discussions may be triggering for some individuals. If you or someone you know is struggling, please seek support from a mental health professional or a trusted individual in your life. Remember, you are not alone and help is available. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Mind Your Head. In this episode, we have Paris Lightfoot. In this episode, Paris shares her inspiring story after losing a loved one to mental illness. She has found her purpose as a mental health advocate by promoting fitness and community as a tool to help people become stronger physically and mentally. Let's get into it. Paris, welcome to Mind Your Head. I really appreciate you joining me in the studio today. I know you're very busy.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
A little bit nervous?
Bit nervous,
that's all right. Firstly, how are you going? How's the first part of 2024 treating you?
Look, we've had ups and downs already and it's, nearly the end of February. So, but I can't complain with gym-wise, work-wise, everything's going really well. Just started back into footy, so loving that. But, yeah, I'm sure we'll delve a little bit deeper into things now.
We will. So you're a gym owner, you're one of the head trainers there, you play AFL footy, you're obviously very passionate about your health and fitness. Has this always been the case for you, even as a young kid growing up, was being active really important to you?
Yeah, definitely. So from as long as I can remember, sport has been just the main thing in my life. I don't know whether that's, I think a lot from my family. My mum was an elite athlete. I think obviously that had an influence on me, but also just being an only child, I think having sport was a way to make friends. It was a way to just enjoy things after school and before school. So, from a very young age, I've delved into every sport that I could play.
So
health and fitness is just always been a priority in my life up until today when I still play footy.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brisbane, Brizzy girl originally, so been all over Brizzy growing up. Went to school at Somerville House in South Bank and primary school at New Farm State School. So yeah, and then I moved to the Gold Coast for university in 2015. So straight out of school, went to Bond Uni, and I've been on the Gold Coast ever since.
Yeah, nice. So I actually told my mum. I'm always asked, like, who's the next guest on? And I said, Paris Lightfoot. And she was like, oh.
The last name ring a
bell? Yeah, the last name ring a bell. And she was like, oh, yeah, I know sort of her dad was quite, you know, well known. And I think I read somewhere that your parents were known as the Kim and Kanye of Brisbane in the 80s.
Yeah, they like to tell me that. Remind me of the it girl, the it couple status.
Yeah. So what was that, looking back on it now, what was it like growing up? Did it come with any challenges?
I think so. Flashback to youngest me. My parents split up. So mum and dad split up when I was about 12 months old. So they weren't together for as long as I can remember. So yeah, I was always split between the two households, majority with mum, fortnights, weekends with dad, and then every other Wednesday or something like that, up all through school and all through growing up. But they were always really close and close friends and maintained a really good relationship. And they did that, obviously, for me as a child. So for as long as I could remember, whilst they were split up, they were still friends. And, I had a really fortunate and lucky upbringing as a child. I was daddy's little princess.
Yes, I was. Yeah.
So being the only child, yeah, I think I was very lucky and spoiled in how I was brought up in the two households.
And with both parents, like you mentioned, your mum being the lead athlete and your dad being a very well-known fashion designer, obviously very driven in their own fields. Is this where, I guess, your core values were instilled from your parents?
Definitely. Yeah. I think from as long as I can remember, I've just been very driven and determined to do whatever it is that I want in my life, and there's nothing that's going to stop me from doing that. And that comes, I think, a lot from my mom. She's been the key driver in those values, and she's someone that I look up to greatly. But also dad, like, to be a well-known fashion designer, he worked hard for that, and that's what he was passionate about, and that showed in his work. So I definitely do get that, from my parents.
And you mentioned that you sort of you know, you played every sport when you were younger. What were your aspirations at that age? Did you, any dreams you wanted to achieve?
So sporting-wise, I played a number of sports trying to find one of them that I was particularly good at.
Yeah.
And none of that really paid off. So I played netball, cross country, athletics, touch footy. Unfortunately, back then I didn't have AFL, and AFL women's wasn't a thing back then. I wish it was, because then I might be a better player for it today. but sporting wise, I always just wanted to strive to be better, and was always looking to improve on whatever sport that was. I never got to, I guess, an elite level in any of those sports, but career-wise, all through school, I always wanted to be a lawyer. So I had tunnel vision on that from a very young age. I don't know why, where I got that from. My mum was a model in her early days, an elite athlete, very creative. She had a marketing and media company as well. And then dad, obviously, a very creative and successful fashion designer. And I sadly did not get those talents. So I cannot draw or anything like that, as much as I love fashion. I used to do a little bit of modeling when I was younger and still dabble a little bit now. Yeah, yeah. But I was just always focused on being a lawyer.
Mm.
And I think I have an uncle that was a lawyer, but I don't know where that came from. That was just...
That was it.
That was it.
Did you feel any pressure or, I guess, a responsibility to be successful because of the influence of your... I guess successful parents. Was there any pressure at all? Did you feel anything like that?
No pressure, but I think, definitely, as I said before, got values from them and just wanted to work hard to be successful in myself.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel any pressure from them. They supported me in whatever I wanted to choose.
Yeah.
And dad, as much as everyone would always say, are you going to take after your dad? Are you going to be a fashion designer?
Yeah.
As much as he would have loved that, he loved the fact that I wanted to pursue law and he bragged about that to everyone.
Did he?
Yeah. He just loved having a daughter that was a lawyer.
But also like just choosing your own path.
Yeah.
Like,
and proud of that. They were proud of that. Mm. And whatever I wanted to do, they supported it. Mm. So there was no pressures, and I think pressure on myself maybe, but...
Mm. Not externally or anything?
No, not externally. I think... Mm. Personally, I'm just always striving to be better in whatever that is I do, and I think that's something I put on myself.
Yes,
yeah,
I do the same. Yeah. These sort of sometimes it can be like unachievable standards.
Yeah,
that I have to like.
Yeah.
Settle down a little bit.
Exactly, in the gym, in footy, in whatever it is, I just won't settle for mediocre. Yeah.
I love that though. So you obviously graduated. Straight into law school?
Yep. So I, straight from high school, graduated when I was 17 from high school in Brizzy. I actually got a scholarship to go to Bond Uni, mixture of leadership. They give all-round scholarships, leadership, education, smartness, all of that. so that was the reason why I left Brizzy. I thought it was a great opportunity to move to the Gold Coast, and I wanted to get out of Brizzy and I guess challenge myself and get out of my comfort zone of what Brizzy was and where I grew up. So, I literally finished school in, what do you finish in, late November.
Mm.
Started at Bond in the first week of January, so a month later.
Mm. Went to schoolies?
Yeah, after schoolies. Yeah, obviously, okay. Went to schoolies on the Gold Coast.
Yeah, okay.
Went to schoolies on the Gold Coast, back to Brizzy, then packed up my life and moved back to the Gold Coast to study law. And, I finished my degree at Bond. 3 years, it's pretty quick. It's a fast track degree there. As soon as I finished that, became a lawyer, got admitted, worked as a lawyer for a few years, and then, made the move.
What did you like about the job to begin with?
So I loved studying law.
Yeah.
And I love the law. I really enjoyed my whole university. Aside from the parties, I enjoyed studying it and the theory of the law and the problem solving and everything that comes with it. And all through uni, I still was set on becoming a lawyer. Got a grad job. Well, actually, I've started as a personal assistant and then worked my way up into a grad job in the firm, Minter Ellison, which is on the Gold Coast. And, I loved it. I loved it to start with. I started off in commercial litigation, so lots of court work, lots of high-pressure work, working on deadlines, which I loved. I thrive on a deadline.
You thrive on that.
I thrive on a, you need to do this by 4 p.m. or else give me 5 weeks to do something and I won't do it.
Oh, really?
Like the night before.
Oh, right.
yeah.
So you need that pressure to perform.
It's a flaw, but also it allows me to get stuff done.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I loved it and then worked my way up, got admitted as a lawyer. I was enjoying the litigation court side of things, so then I moved into estate litigation, was in estates. And, yeah, I was really enjoying it. I worked my way up and got promoted to an associate, which is, I guess, when you're in that, anyone out there that's a lawyer knows that you get admitted, you become a lawyer, you work from a grad to a lawyer, associate, senior associate, partner. Mm. And that is where you want to work your way up.
Yeah.
And so I got to an associate pretty quickly before I was 2 years post-admission. So that's pretty quick.
High achiever.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah. I just... As I said before, I had my eyes set on, like, eyes on the prize. That's where I wanted to get. And then I got there and I just found myself, I wasn't happy in what I was doing. And, yeah, that's when I started reflecting on my career.
Mm. Was there always, like, an underlining feeling that, obviously, your love for health and fitness, did you think that that could lead you in away from law?
Yes. Yeah. So, yes and no. I always, like... wanted to be a sports lawyer.
Oh, cool.
And so I thought that was going to be the coolest thing ever. Yeah. And then I got into the law and I got out in the real world. I'm like, that is just not a thing.
Mm.
It's just, it's not. Like, there's.
What would be a sport lawyer?
It's, well, yeah, exactly.
When they get fined and have to go to judiciary.
Yeah,
and get,
so there's like very limited amount of sports lawyers out there. I always wanted to work for the AFL or something like that and do all the contracts and negotiation and legal work for something like that or a big sporting body. And there's very few out there and there's not much work out there. So I think immediately when I got into my role as a grad, I was like, that's what I want to be. And everyone was like, yeah, that's not going to happen. Sorry. So dreams were crushed at an early time of being a sports lawyer, but I did do some work for our firm, worked on the Commonwealth Games. So that was an exciting, like, kind of little bit into what sports and media law could be. I always, like, throughout being a lawyer, I was always going to the gym every day. I was playing footy still. So whilst everyone was still at their desk working, I'd go to footy training at 5:30, and then if I still had work to do, would come back and do it or do it afterwards. But my priority was I need to go to footy training for my mental health, my sanity, and my happiness. So I guess that's what also caused the reflection is what do I really want to do? Because sport, fitness, and all of that has just been the biggest part of my life for my whole life. So when that was becoming less and less and the law was taking over, that obviously caused me to reflect on.
Did you see a shift in your mental health when...
Definitely, it did. Yeah. So I think COVID was a really big turning point as well. And for a lot of people, obviously being in lockdown and then working as a lawyer, working from home, when all of that shifted, I think that's when I saw a shift in my mental health. And also that then when we went back to work triggered the, okay, what am I really doing here? But yeah, working from home, sitting at your laptop from morning to night, at your home, there's no separation from it. And yeah, it was stressful and all consuming in terms of you couldn't switch off from the work and you couldn't go and play sport. You could only go out and do a run. And I hated that.
And it can be like hard having your home as work too. It's nice sort of leaving your home, going to work, coming back, and then knowing that you can sort of like switch off when you come home.
Yeah.
But knowing that, you know, your desk is at home is your, is your work.
There was no boundaries. Yeah, so there's nothing. Like, well, I may as well just keep working and finish this stuff off. And then you realize, oh, it's
been
12 o'clock at night. Or, you get up early and say, oh, I'll just get ahead of it for the day. And then you realize you started early and it's now 6 p.m. So I guess that those habits... And everyone was in the same boat, not just me. Like everyone, I guess, working from home would have had those same struggles mentally. But then when we went back to work, the pressures, the long hours, as a lawyer, anyone would know the billable hours is a big stress. And it's like logging every minute of your day. What are you doing?
Yeah.
I feel like that got me. That got me. Yeah. The stress of the financial stress of being a lawyer and performing and getting those targets, and obviously it's a business, right? So you have to earn money. But what I wanted to do, I just wanted to help people. And I just wanted to problem solve to help people. And for me, I'm like, I wasn't getting enough satisfaction in helping.
That fulfillment that you're sort of searching for.
I wasn't getting that. And then I tried to do a lot of not for profit work and working for charities. Mm. And yeah, so I started doing a lot of that work, and the estate work I really enjoyed as well, like helping people that were financially disadvantaged or cut out of wills or things like that.
Yeah.
To try and get them funds. I started doing a lot more of that work to try and get fulfillment, but I still just wasn't happy. And I found that I wasn't wanting to get out of bed in the morning to go to work.
And that's a sign,
and that's a sign. Mm. When I just didn't want to get out of bed, and my partner will say the same thing every day. I don't want to go. I don't want to get up. I don't want to go there. As much as I love the people at my work, it was nothing against them. It was I didn't want to do what I was doing.
Yeah.
And that's like, that was a light bulb moment. Why am I doing it? Mm. If I don't want to get out of bed, then there's something wrong here.
And that's a process that I've gone through, is asking that question, what success means to you. Mm. And it can mean so many things to so many different people. And one of the aspects of success for me is getting out of bed and being excited. Like the first 3 seconds, if you're not excited to get out of bed and do the thing that you're doing, you're probably not doing the right thing.
Exactly. And I have that now. I have that excitement.
Oh, nice.
Although it's 4 a.m. and it's hard to be excited.
Hard to be excited.
Once I'm actually up and registering things, I am excited. And I love what I do now. Mm. And I'm so glad that I took the jump and the risk early on in my life whilst I could still get out of that. Because a lot of people do just get stuck in the law. Like, you want to be a lawyer. That's what your family did. Mm. You work your way up. You want to be a partner. They get to that stage and then it's too late. They're successful. They're a successful partner. How are they going to change now?
It is so tough, because, like, I know, like you said, I know a lot of people who get stuck in like that safe job and like the fear of change or the fear of trying something new and that fear of like the unknown can be too much, and they just never do it.
Yeah.
Well, I was chatting to a friend and they were saying that they're afraid to leave because they will feel like a failure because they put so much time and effort and energy into this job or whatever it is. And for them to do it and go, oh, I actually don't like this, they feel guilty and a little bit of like, you know, they feel bad that they feel like a failure for not sort of pursuing that.
Yeah.
Did you feel like any of that with you, or how did you navigate that?
Really. What caused me to reflect was looking above me and looking at the ladies, particularly the women in the law firm above me, and looking at other successful females in the industry and looking at their lives. What is their life balance like, and what do I want out of my life? I'm an active person. I always want to be active. That is my priority. Family is one of my number one values. I want to be able to have that life balance when I eventually have a family.
Mm.
Not saying that I'm going to be pregnant anytime soon. In the next few years, that is what I would want. And I looked above and I saw the long hours, the stress. They drop their kids off or pick them up from school but then have to go back and work long hours. And part-time law, like, it's not part-time. If you work part-time, you're either doing more hours on the days that you work, from my experience, or you end up working on days that you have off.
Yeah.
And so, that's what caused me to think, no, that's not for me. And then when I was deciding what I want to do, the opportunity came up for the gym and I thought, great, that is actually exactly what I would love to do. I'm passionate about sport and fitness. I want to help people. I'm all about community. And so that opportunity to create my own community is exactly what I want. And at the time, I was super passionate about helping people with disabilities as well. That was a lot of the charity work I was doing. So I'm like, this is going to be able to give me so much more freedom to do what I actually want to do.
It sort of like ties in everything.
Everything. Yeah. So I guess I didn't have that fear of, oh, I've failed. It was more, I've given it a red hot crack. That was what I believed I wanted to do and I was so set on doing, and I got to where I wanted. That's a success. It's not a failure.
Yeah.
But what is that what I want to do for the rest of my life that will make me happy? No. So let's find something that will.
Yeah.
And I guess there was a fear of, and a lot of other people saying, well, what if your business fails and rada rada? So, well, that is true. But I may as well try it while I'm 25 years old rather than and I've got no kids. I've got no one else to rely on me.
It's the best time to do it in your life is now. And if you don't try it, you know it will be. Yeah. Like, you know you fail, but if you give it a go.
Yeah. So I guess I'm not scared of failure, and I've always been one to take risks or to put myself out of my comfort zone. And I think that comes from my mum and how I was brought up is to just give it a red hot crack.
Mm. That was my next question, was that you're someone, as I see, is very driven and resilient.
Yeah.
And not afraid to take risks. Have you ever struggled with self-doubt, or has self-doubt ever held you back in life?
Yes and no. There's always that in the back of your mind, the negative talk. I guess everyone struggles with that in some way. But I would say I'm all in all a very confident person. And try not to let those negatives get the better of me. Yes, in sport, very much so, I doubt myself or doubt my ability.
Why is that?
I don't know. There's something about it that I've just, because I've never been the best at something, and there's so many more talented people out there. I've always been the person that's had to work 20 times harder than the person next to me to even be on that same level playing field.
Yeah.
So I guess there's that self-doubt in my mind. If I don't work for it, I'm not that good. But in terms of career-wise, I don't know. I don't know why I haven't. Maybe it's a bit of delusion, but I just always back myself in to give it a go.
I felt the same on the footy field.
Yeah.
So I figured out this weird thing that would happen to me, like, mentally. If I played against people that I didn't know, if I didn't know who they are or what school they went to or what teams they made, I would kill it. I would have such a good game.
Yeah.
But if my dad or the coaches would be like, oh, do you know who those players were? And I was like, no. And they're like, they're so-and-so signed with some club.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, fuck. And then suddenly,
the doubt.
I would just be like, oh, shit, why I'm not good enough to be out here.
Yeah.
When if I didn't know about it, I was just like going along doing my thing.
Yeah. I'm the same. So I think in sport, self-doubt and confidence has always been an issue for me, but I don't know why, but in the real world, it's not. It's just, it's just, I guess,
How do you overcome it when you're playing footy?
I think as I've gotten older, it's definitely helped. Maturity and years of experience under my belt has helped. But as a young player, I was scared. I didn't doubt myself. If I had a bad game, I would beat myself up about it. And then the confidence from there just trickles on, right? If you then thinking, oh, every time I go to catch a ball, I'm going to drop it and nervous. And I think something just clicked one year. I don't know why, but I just decided to start playing for fun.
Yes.
And just no pressure. Like, I'm not going to get drafted. Like, just no pressure. Just go out there and have fun and enjoy it with your mates. And that was the best season I ever had. Mm. I wasn't worried about my performance. And that's when it clicked. And the self, that there is still a little bit of doubt, but now I'm a much more confident player and will back myself in. And that also comes down to working my ass off on things that I need to.
Mm.
And so I know if I stand next to my opponent, I can say, well, I've done the work. And that's one thing our coach also always talks about. You can stand next to them and there's false confidence and true confidence.
Mm.
And the true confidence comes from putting in the work. And I do the hours of extras. They can be the most talented person, but have they done the hours of fitness or extras that I've done? And that's what gives myself the confidence to then
go out and perform.
I still might not be as good as them, but at least in my mind, I'm confident enough to give it a crack.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that's one of the things that I linked when I was playing footy. I linked my self-worth with outcome.
Mm.
So like we just said, if we played shit or the team lost, I'll blame me.
Mm.
And it really like, I really struggled with it for years. And then a sports psychologist said to me, how about you link it with your intentions? So if you know that before the game, during the week, you did all the training, all the skills, all the work that you needed to do, and you're happy with it, whatever happens on Saturday or Sunday, whatever day you play, then so be it.
Yeah.
But you can, if you lose, you can reflect and go, listen, we may have lost, I may have dropped the ball, whatever, but during that week, all my intentions were lined up. And that's what I can sort of be happy with rather than that final outcome.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely. And just relieving the pressure of the outcome.
Yeah. Because I went through the same thing. I played when you sort of get higher and play sort of higher, the fun sort of goes. And because you're playing, I guess, professionally, their winning sort of takes over.
Mm.
And I hated it because I play for fun and I love joking around. Like, even before we run out, I hate the serious stuff.
Oh, no, I'm full serious.
Oh, no, I love, like, if someone cracks a joke, I'm like, yes. Because that's how I sort of, like, that's how I play.
That's how you relieve your stress as well.
Yeah, that's how I relieve my stress. I'm like, oh, yeah, just relax. It's all good. You're going to have fun. And when I sort of made teams and went higher, it was life or death.
Yeah.
And then I had to sort of bring it back. And I played a season, like you just said, for fun and for the love of it with my mates. And it was one of the funnest years ever. We won the comp and we were mucking around and like throwing the footy and
when you have fun, and for me fun is winning, so
that is true.
So
though
I would say, as much as I relieved the pressure and I wanted to have fun, I'm a competitive beast, and
I can tell
do anything to win and play as a team and get the job done, but it was more the personal pressure of putting it on me, like, oh, that was a bad kick for me. That was a bad – I did this wrong. It's like stripping that back and think about, hang on, there's 16 other girls out there on the field. This is a team sport. Don't worry so much about what I'm doing. If I can put in on my strengths and voice and leadership and other things and focus on those and then have a bit more fun without, pressuring myself so much, that's when it all clicked.
Was there any extra pressure when you got named captain?
It took me a few years to work my way up there. So.
Oh, did it? Yeah.
So
what's it
not
like now?
So much.
It's not so much now.
I played with Bond for a long time now, since I started there in 2015.
Yeah.
So when I started uni, never played footy before. So we were fresh. And a lot of the girls at uni, we'd just played netball, whatever. We'd all come together to play footy. So early days, it was very much just a social thing.
Yeah.
And then as the years went on, started enjoying it more, and obviously the person in me was like, I need to get better at this because I don't like being average. So as the years went on, the team got better. It drove me to become better. Yeah. It just became something that I obviously wanted to be better at. And I never was the best. I was in and out of the reserves team, reserves and seniors. Then I was the reserves captain 1 year, and then the next year, this is the year where I took all the stress away, and then ended up being a senior player consistently for that year. And as I said, something just clicked that I started enjoying it and confidence grew, and that's when I started growing as a player. And then the year after that, I got named as the senior captain, which was just mind-blowing because, as I said, I've always doubted myself as a player, and I'm not the best player.
Mm.
I'm not good enough to be the captain, but I think it was just acknowledging, hang on, my peers have obviously voted for me for a reason, and that's leadership, not so much skills. So it was just knowing my strengths and
that's it, isn't it?
Thinking about how can I best lead the group as a leader, lead by example and my work ethic and what I do. It doesn't matter if I'm the best or not. But that also came with a number of years playing and growing as a leader, as an athlete as well.
I can imagine you give some pretty good pre-game speeches.
I don't know. I have to ask my teammates I'd hope so. It always gets me so nervous. Like the week before a game, I'll listen to podcasts. I'll listen to other like elite athletes. Like I listen
bit of Kobe Bryant or something.
I listen to those hype up speeches and I think about who we're playing and I do put a lot of thought into those things because I do take it seriously. It's something that I really care about, and I care about my teammates and obviously care about winning. So how do I get the best out of my teammates? And I hope sometimes I give them a little bit of a amp up in the pregame.
Well, we can call one now if you want. Finding one's passion and purpose in life is something that everyone has searched for and some people are still searching for. How you talked a little bit about that process been for you. How have you sort of navigated your passion and purpose? And when do you know? Is it a gut feeling? Is it like getting out of bed in the morning?
Yeah, that definitely helped when you reflect on your happiness or where you're at. And if you find that, well, for me, obviously, it was the not wanting to get out of bed, not wanting to go to work. If you dread what you're doing, that's obviously a number one sign. But for me now, in a space where I'm loving what I'm doing and I've found, I guess, my purpose and my passion, it's, yeah, I want to get up in the morning. I want to work above and beyond to do what I'm doing and to get the most out of the business, but the most out of my members, and to build the best community that I can. And that gives me so much joy, happiness, fulfillment. And yeah, if you can find something that gives you that joy, whether it's, yeah, in sport, work, whatever that may be, I think definitely search for that fulfillment and joy.
Because that's something that I've only recently realized, that from my own experience, that passion is the exit point, mm-hmm. not the entry point. And I think a lot of people put pressure on themselves to whatever the job they're in or whatever they're doing is to feel passion straight away. And if you don't feel it, it's either you're not passionate or you quit your job or whatever it may be. But I think when you find something that you actually want to get out of bed for, that you actually enjoy and it aligns with your values and, you know, you feel a part of something and included, I think the exit point is passion. So that's like one of the things that I sort of tell my friends and even Jordan, my partner, who sometimes struggles with a passion. And I was like, how about you just truly find something that you enjoy, something you're excited to get out of bed for, and keep searching for it, keep looking for it. And the exit point will be, that's your passion. That's what you're passionate about.
Yeah, and exactly. It's going to take trial and error, right?
Absolutely.
I thought I was going to be passionate about the law, and I was until a few years in. It took me a few years of actually doing it to realize, well, that's not actually what I want to do with my life. And then I was just lucky enough that now that I'm in this space of creating my own gym community and owning a gym, that is what I'm passionate about. And there's going to be things that off that as well that I'm going to want to do as well. But it's going to take me doing different things and trialing it to truly find, yeah, what I want to do. Because I know, like, helping people, number one, mental health, number two, people with disabilities. I guess overarching thing is just is helping people is probably the main thing. But that gives me fulfillment and joy and is what I'm passionate about, particularly with the overarching sport and fitness. But, yeah, it's going to take my whole life doing little bibs and bobs, and I'll have probably a number of passions and so will other people, but you've got to give it a go.
Yeah.
And it is hard with obviously now like cost of living, financial stresses and all that. It is difficult. But while you're young enough, I guess, is what I try and tell my friends and or people below me that are studying things, don't worry so much about that. Like, I know it's hard and you'll struggle, but if it doesn't work out, we'll try something else. And you might have to do a few jobs and things like that to obviously pay for your living. But, yeah, you want to try and do what you can to find what your end goal is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We all experience turning points in our life. I've definitely gone through mine, and it makes us look at the world a little bit differently. Why is being an advocate for mental health so important to you?
Yeah, so obviously, a turning point in my life was 14 months ago, I lost my dad to suicide. So that was the turning point in terms of why I want to do everything I can to help others with their mental health and just to have conversations like this around it, to stop people like my dad and from losing their lives and from others losing their loved ones to mental health battles. So yeah, that was 14 months ago now. I guess we can delve into that.
Well, I've never been comfortable asking this question. What is it like losing a loved one to suicide, and how did the loss of your father impact your life?
So, as I said, 14 months ago, it happened now. So I'm still very much in the thick of it. I am not someone that's, can turn back and say, oh, I'm out of the grief stage, I'm out of that. I'm very much in the thick of it, still living it, still dealing with it. So it definitely, the first 12 months, so last year was a blur. That was probably the fastest year of my life last year. So Christmas Day 2022 is when it happened. And I found out Boxing Day morning. My auntie just called me early in the morning. It was Boxing Day, so my grandma's birthday. So the tradition is we all celebrate Christmas Day. I was at my mum's side of the family. So mum's mum, grandma's birthday, we're getting ready to go over to her place for brunch and a bit of a birthday celebration, and it's early morning and I see my auntie, my dad's sister, calling me. And that's like immediately I just had this gut feeling that something was wrong, because it was just strange for her to be calling me on Boxing Day morning. And I don't really remember the phone call, but I remember the tone in her voice immediately. That must have been like the hardest phone call she had to make, because, yeah, I just remember her telling me, and I was with my mum on the couch. She said to me, I do remember that, like, is your mum here? Make sure you go get your mum. And that's when I was immediately like, oh, no, this is not good. So I sat next to mum and had the news, and I think I was just in shock, complete shock, and just didn't really register. I remember calling my partner straight away, calling my two best, or my best friends, but particularly two of them who had also lost their dads to suicide. So I just remember calling them, and they were just completely heartbroken. But they're the ones that I turned to first because they've been through it, right? So, yeah, and then I still went to my grandma's, saw all my family, and obviously mum told them, and it was just, it was a strange, looking back, a strange situation, because I've obviously just hadn't processed it. Mm. I'm like, I need to go see my grandma. She's old. This, like, we don't know how many birthdays she has. She's my number one priority.
So you could just, you just had to block it out.
I honestly think I did. Like, yeah. I just went straight to grandma's.
Mm.
Like, obviously the shock, I cried. I was like sobbing and sad, but I think I was just hadn't processed. So yeah, and then I went to work the next week. So the gym was closed on the public holidays, or Boxing Day, Christmas. Then we were staying in Brisbane at the time, went back to the Gold Coast, and yeah, I had to get straight back into running the gym, taking classes, which was hard. I mean, I took a few days in between when my friends came over, Jacko was supporting me, and I took the time to, I guess, try and process what was happening. But in hindsight, I honestly don't think I've processed it until now.
Really?
Yeah. So the first 12 months last year was just a blur. I think I was just in, like, eyes on the prize, run the business, and I just put all my energy
in. Tunnel vision. Yeah, yeah.
Tunnel vision. Mm. Blocked it out. Sport, training, run the business. And I just, like,
was that your way of coping with it?
I think it, like,
yeah.
It's only the past, like, month or so that has caused me to reflect. And obviously then when you asked me to come on the podcast, I did some reflecting. And yeah, the first 12 months I was just putting all my energy into everything other than processing it. And so it hasn't been till, well, about 6 months after he died is when it started to come a little bit more, like, real life.
Real, yeah.
When you, like, can't call them or can't do things like that. Sorry.
It's okay.
And, yeah. Then his birthday in November. And Christmas. Christmas was hard. And, yeah, I think since Christmas, a year on, it's been really difficult, and I'm facing new challenges in terms of the grieving process since then. But I think you just don't realize how much in denial that first stage is, and you kind of block it out. Like, last year was such a blur. And as I said, yeah, I just put all my energy into other things, which in hindsight, I don't know if I should have done or not, but it was just how I coped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can't imagine there's a right and wrong sort of way to go
about it. And that's what, like, I obviously had my days and weeks where I would cry and let it out, and I did have emotional ups and downs, obviously. And there was a really dark time in last year when my partner Jacko went to Melbourne, because financially we couldn't afford him not to. Mm. I was living on my own, running the business on my own. It was really hard. Yeah, last year, the first 12 months had a lot of ups and downs, and just trying to navigate, I guess, losing someone. But one thing that I guess is really clear to me, there's obviously grief of losing a parent, and there's grief to losing someone to suicide. And that is the guilt, the initial guilt that us as a family felt. Especially when on Christmas Day we weren't with Dad on Christmas Day. So a little bit of a backtrack into Dad's struggles is he suffered from depression and anxiety for a long, long time. So since I was in school, his story, as we said, he's a successful fashion designer in Brisbane, extremely successful, the life of the party, one of the happiest, most outgoing people that I know. And the turning point for him was when his manager of his business and his accountant were working together and stole a lot of money from him. So his business went under. So there was him going into bankruptcy, the business going under. That was the turning point that triggered his mental illness when I was still in school. So I can't remember how old, but still grade 7 or 8. So pretty young. So at that point, I didn't know what depression was, what mental health was at all whatsoever. I just knew that one day I got home from school, it was my turn to go to Dad's house, and he's in bed crying and said, "I've been diagnosed with depression." And so I still didn't know, and him just explaining that he's got medication and all of that, that he's going to be all right. Track on 10 years, we always knew that he struggled with mental illness. He's always had his medication and we've always gone ups and downs trying to get him better. We just never knew the extent, obviously, to what he struggled with. And it's taken till after he's died for me to be able to go through his stuff and everything to find out exactly what he struggled with, because he didn't tell anyone. He didn't tell us his struggles. He didn't tell us about the panic attacks, the anxiety attacks. He got admitted to hospital so many times without any of us family members knowing. So we just knew that he had these struggles, right? But you never knew, because it went on for so long. He had medication that you just didn't know that it would ever get to this point, which was really hard. And I guess when I moved to the Gold Coast for uni, I saw him less and less. He came to all my footy games to watch when I was in Brisbane, and he drove to the Gold Coast sometimes. And whenever I saw him, he put on the brave face and he was the out there flamboyant dad that I knew. So he masked that. And it, I guess it's hard to, when you lose someone, to not blame yourself for, why did I not see the signs? Why did he not talk to me? Why were we not with him on Christmas Day? Then it wouldn't have happened. Like, all of those things go through your mind. And I think he's got two sisters, so his sisters, myself and my mom, those, that the initial like week or 2 weeks was just like guilt. Like, how could we have stopped this? And how did we not know that it was this bad? And I think that's what everyone who's known someone or a loved one that's taken their life, you have that guilt and a little bit of anger and things like that in that initial stage. So I think it took talking to my friends, which I was lucky. Well, it's not lucky, but fortunate that I've had my two best friends have gone through the same thing, and we can lean on each other, and I've been able to lean on them. As morbid as it is, we call out each other the Dead Dad Club, which if you don't cry, if you don't laugh, you'll cry about it. So we choose to laugh and lean on each other, and we've been super lucky to have that, and they've been a key of getting me particularly out of that hole of guilt of blaming yourself.
What advice have they given you?
Well, mainly just that you can't blame yourself, that it's an illness. You can't, as much as in the early stages and there's so many things you can do to help people, you cannot stop it, and it's not my fault as a daughter. And that was my, like, the first few months was just crying myself to sleep thinking about, well, was I a bad daughter and could I have stopped this, which is so hard. And you beat yourself up, but you just can't. And so I guess, yeah, that's one thing that I've learnt over the past year is don't blame yourself. You're going to get those feelings of guilt. That's inevitable. You can't avoid that. But you just got to talk to people about it, and they're going to reassure you as well that it's not your fault.
What's your understanding of mental health and, I guess, suicide now?
I'm continuously growing and educating myself on mental health, depression, anxiety, because before it all happened, I couldn't relate. I didn't understand it. I couldn't relate to the feelings that Dad had when I was younger. I was too young, didn't know. And then I guess I'd never experienced anxiety or depression or anything myself before. And then obviously when he passed, it's been educating myself on just more and more, which is I'm going to continue to do throughout my life now, and obviously now that it's something I'm passionate about. I'm just going to continue, and I think I can relate a lot more now because one of, I guess you could say, symptoms of grief is anxiety, and I'm experiencing that a lot more now that I'm going through this process. So it is a little bit easier to relate, not to the extent, but yeah, just continuously educating myself, having conversations, talking to people, asking about how they feel and things like that so that I can relate more. I think one of my huge flaws was not having enough empathy or not knowing enough of how Dad would have felt.
I've gone through my own battles with depression and anxiety, and I sort of, my mates, we all talk about it every now and again, and it's very, very hard for me to put into words what it feels like, because all my mates are all pretty open with our mental health, and they will ask questions like, is this what it felt like? How do you know? Like, what are the thoughts? What are the feelings? And like I said, it's so hard to like paint you a picture of what it's like and how bad it is. But for me, it felt like you were just in this bubble that felt like you're alone. That even though I wasn't, even though that I had all my friends and family there, like you said, it is an illness. It felt like nothing else mattered. I felt like I was in this dark cloud of a bubble, and it was just me in there by myself.
Yeah. And I think that's definitely right. But what made that worse for my dad is he was by himself. So he put himself, there's his bubble of, in his mind, and then there was the actual physical bubble of he put himself by himself.
Did he separate himself?
He isolated himself. Did he? Another like really tough thing was he didn't have a mobile because he just removed himself so that we couldn't contact him. So within that like 6 to 10 months before he died, I could not contact him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's another thing that obviously added to it, but he'd been one, like it didn't trigger in me like this is really bad because he's gone through ups and downs where he doesn't have a phone and he doesn't communicate, and then you see him again, he comes to my footy game and whatnot. He'd go up and down of having phones.
So that wasn't unusual.
Yeah. Obviously, like, I would contact him, try and contact, and sometimes he'd answer, sometimes he'd get a new phone and say, this is my new number or whatever. But in hindsight, that's obviously him trying, he's just going into his own little bubble and not wanting to, reach out. And he didn't want anyone to know how bad it was. And I think that was a part of the shame because he was such a successful fashion designer and everyone knew him as this amazing life of the party, happy, hilarious guy. And that when he wasn't that anymore, he lost who he was and he didn't want people to see him. But yeah, isolation, I would say, is for myself as well. When I'm going through struggles, you tend to want to just be by yourself. But one of the biggest things is surround yourself with your loved ones.
Yeah.
As hard as it is.
Yeah. Is there any misconceptions or maybe what the media or society get wrong about people, I guess, with a mental illness that you've found during this sort of journey?
I think a lot of people are, well, why didn't he just go to the psych, take his meds and then he's fixed? It's like, it's not like that. And for a long time when I was younger and I didn't realize myself, I was annoyed. Why can't my dad just be my dad and I'm having to like parent my dad and and be like, it's okay, like, let's do this, let's get you back on track with this. And it was a battle that we dealt with, but we just never knew the extent because he obviously didn't share the extent of his struggles and the panic attacks and the anxiety attacks and going off and on meds and things like that. But, yeah, I don't know. And I guess media as well paints that successful people, people with money or things like that can't have struggles.
You're
as
immune
well.
To,
they're immune to it because they're successful and I think maybe those people are more prone to it because they feel like they can't, like Dad, they feel like they can't share their struggles because they've got this image that they need to uphold.
They're not allowed to sort of express their sort of emotions and stuff. And that's the thing, like I think there's still a stigma around it. I know that it's getting – I know mental health in general is getting talked about more than ever before, but the numbers aren't getting better.
No.
And I still feel like there's a stigma around talking about mental health. How do we break it?
I don't know. Obviously, conversations like this help getting vulnerable, but it is hard because it's particularly that older generation as well, that there might be – our generation that are starting these conversations and stuff and working really hard to try and to break that stigma. But it is hard for those older generations. And it's really – it's horrifying the amount of friends and people that I know that have lost their fathers to suicide. It really is. And so it's just doing whatever we can in terms of these conversations, checking in on mates, spreading awareness so that the more people that know, I guess, starting from us, the younger generations, and hopefully then moving forward, obviously, it's not going to be so bad to talk about these things.
It's getting that dialogue in early, like I've talked about with Jordan. Like, I never had that dialogue. My parents are great, but we never had a dialogue where a check-in.
Yeah.
How's your day at school?
Yeah.
Nothing like that. Not saying they didn't love us, but we just didn't, like, that's their generation. And I remember telling to Jordan, like, when we have kids, I want to have that open dialogue where they know sort of their emotions and know how to properly regulate their emotions and they know how to identify which emotions, and it's healthy to express all them.
Yeah.
But just being in control and know how to, like, handle them.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm.
And I think the numbers are horrifying, but hopefully by doing conversations and educating from a young age will help in the future generations. Like I said, when we found out Dad had depression and I was in school, I'm in grade 7 and 8. I'm smart enough to know these things, but we just had no idea. Mm. There was no one coming into schools saying, these are the signs, this is how you check in on your mate, this is the, like, there was no education around it at all. I would have had no idea how to check in on a mate if they were acting differently or they seemed like depressed in school or they had anxiety. I didn't even know what that was.
You wouldn't even know what to look for.
No, nowadays, at least if we start those conversations, start educating people, and which we are, and it's getting out there more, that maybe if we were in grade 7 and I saw the signs, then I would be equipped to check in and do it early in life rather than when it's too late.
Yeah, and you nailed it there with the education. I think we need to educate ourselves around suicide and other mental health issues, and I think we need to challenge that narrative that suicide is a selfish act. And I think we need to promote sort of understanding, compassion, because it's an illness. Like you said, it's an illness, and it's the only disease that we actually blame the person. Like, when someone's got cancer, we never blame that person. But with sort of suicide and mental health, we do. And our mutual friend Brock, he said, he was on the podcast and he said something really important to me. He said when his father lost his battle with his mental illness, he went to his GP, who was also his dad's GP. And he just said, Brock, I just want you to know that don't judge your dad. Don't look at him differently. That wasn't him. It's an illness, and don't let that ruin the good memories of you and your dad. And it's so true. And he said to me, it wasn't him. And that sort of gave him some sort of...
Yeah, definitely. Mm. And and I've listened to that podcast, and I've listened to my friends, and I've listened to a number of other people that have helped me through that struggle, because you do, when it happens, you immediately have the guilt and you have the blame and the why could you have not held on for me as your only daughter and things like that. But you can't, because you have to reflect. He loved me so much, and he obviously was not in his right mind, and it's an illness.
Mm.
And it was all consuming for him. And obviously that's the point that he was at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do want to let you know that I really respect and admire people like you and people like Brock and many more people out there that help break the cycle. I can only imagine how hard and how much strength it would take to be this open and to talk about it and turn something so tragic into, I guess, into a positive where you can help the next person struggling.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate that.
Well, yeah, thank you. I hope, yeah, I guess me being vulnerable and having these tough conversations hopefully helps either someone that's in the same boat as me or yeah, just some other person out there that might relate to anything like this, yeah.
How's the relationship with your mum? How's it changed?
Yeah, well, the relationship with my mum, she's always been my best friend through my whole life, obviously, an extremely driven and strong lady that I admire and look up to, and she's been my rock throughout this whole process, because obviously only child, losing dad, I've had to, the day after, organize the funeral. Like, everything falls on me, which you don't realize until it happens. Funeral, estate, all of dad's stuff, cleaning out his storage, cleaning out where he lived, all of that. And I would not have been able to do that without mum, because she honestly, although she lost her childhood friend, obviously father to me, and they were friends for many, many years, and her first love, and she lost that, but she was able to stay strong for me through that whole process, which I'm forever grateful for. And obviously she, yeah, it's just, we've become closer through it, I guess, but we've always been best friends. But I guess losing one parent, you now rely heavily on the other one. And, yeah, I'm very grateful for it.
What has been the impact that Jackson has had on your life, especially during this?
Oh, now I'm going to cry.
Oh, now you're going to cry.
Yeah. I guess I always knew I was lucky to have him, but when you lose someone, you really realize who your true friends are. Yeah, he's been my rock through it all last year, and I can imagine it would be extremely difficult for him as well. So I completely acknowledge that he would be having a tough time dealing with me going through a tough time as well. Because, yeah, I'm up and down, and I'm realizing that that is, I guess, what grief is having really, really shit weeks. Then I might be happy the next, and then it just comes in waves. And I suppose dealing with that would be really difficult as well. And he's never experienced something like this, and having to support someone that's gone through this. So we're both in new territory, but I guess it's definitely made us stronger as a couple. And I'm so thankful to have him as such an amazing person, best friend, someone to talk to, and as well as my best friends, and as I've mentioned them a few times, but Ali and Jenna have been amazing, as long as all of my other friends. But I think as well, he's been able to reach and lean on them as well, and how to
deal with it in his way. Yeah,
they've been through it, and all my friends have been amazing, and I'm so grateful to have the close friends that I do, because I could just. I remember in the first few weeks, I'd just message them and say, hey guys, I just need you to come over. And they would bring food over, and we'd play board games, watch shows, and I would just be able to just sit there and sometimes not even talk, and we'd just hang out. And that's just what I needed.
Yeah.
And same with Jacko, like, we don't have to talk, but he just lets me cry or
be you.
Be me, and I don't have to be stressed about that, and I don't have to worry about hide how I'm feeling at all. So I'm very grateful for that, yeah. But I do feel sorry for him. Having to deal with the emotions of up and down. And I think, as I said last year, he went away for a number of months, and that was hard on both of us. So he had to, financially, he had to go back home and play footy, get paid to play footy and help run the family business, because financially, running a small business, we had no income, like the first year of our business. So one of us had to do something about it and go earn money, and that was him. And unfortunately, that meant that he had to move to Melbourne. So we did long distance for a fair few months, and that was in the early stages, in the first 6 months of me losing Dad. So that was extremely difficult, I bet, on him, because he obviously couldn't be
with you,
with me, and he was away from me, he was away from our friends, he was away from everything, he was away from our dogs. But yeah, extremely hard on me. Looking back, I actually don't know how I got through it, because obviously with my friends and my gym community, because they were amazing. And the reason that I got out of bed each day was for my gym community, and because that is what I was passionate about, helping them. So I'm so glad that I had that purpose to keep me going each day, because otherwise I'm sure I would have gone into a deep, deep hole. Because living by yourself,
like you said, trying to grieve, isolation.
You can't help but start to spiral a little bit in your own head when you're by yourself and you don't have someone to lean on. But thankfully then, he came back, and I've had him to lean on since. And then, this year, I guess 14 months post is bringing new challenges and new stages of grief, that new things that I've never felt in my life. So it's like anxiety and not wanting to see people, or like social anxiety. Like, I've always just been a really social person, but some days I find like it's just too much.
Too much.
Yeah.
How has this moment changed your outlook on life and your priorities and maybe your values and what you want out of life?
Yeah. It's obviously losing a parent and is life-changing for everyone. I guess it does make you value everything in life, and has made me even more focused on doing what I want to do and making the most out of everything. Just doing what I'm passionate and taking risks to do what I want, because life is short, and you do realize that when you lose someone, which is cliche, I know, but I guess you appreciate people more, you appreciate your family more, your friends more, greater appreciation of everything.
What's your vision for Active Ashmore?
I have big goals.
What do you hope for people to get out of your gym?
Yeah, so the reason that I'm so passionate about helping people in fitness and on their health and fitness journeys is mainly the how it makes people feel.
Yes.
So training for me is everything in terms of my mental health. And having a hard workout is just, it makes my day. It makes me feel so much better mentally and physically. So for me, I always say movement is medicine. That's just the line that I use, because it's so true that if you move every day, if you do something that you enjoy, if you train, your mind will be better for it, your body will be better for it. So what I'm trying to grow in our community is, no matter who you are, no matter what fitness level, if you've never done exercise in your life, that doesn't matter, because everyone's going to benefit from it mentally and physically. If you've got fitness goals that you want to reach, whether it's chin-ups, bench press, you want to run a half marathon, whatever that may be, those are great goals to have. But reaching those goals are going to help your mental health as well. So yeah, I'm a big preacher of that, and just creating a community at the gym where everyone's welcome. Everyone's welcome on that journey, and everyone in the community supports each other and is inclusive and encouraging, and everyone's on that like-minded path.
And that social connection, we were talking about, like one of the things is like that no one wants to feel isolated or alone, and like having building that sort of community and that social connection of like that shared struggle at the gym where everyone's like just going through the hurt together. And
so our tagline at the gym is, we train hard, we train smart, we achieve together. Nice. And that that sums it up. Like, we are struggling through those tough workouts, but if you've got people next to you backing you, encouraging you, saying you can do it, you'll get it done. You'll push yourself that extra bit further than you think you mentally can, and then afterwards you feel amazing. And there's no better feeling than after a hard workout, your teammates pushing you, your gym mates, whoever it is, and there's no better feeling after that of accomplishment of, yes, I did this hard workout. And so it's definitely, I think I get that from the sporting environment, obviously, and then that's what I want to create in the gym, is that team atmosphere.
That camaraderie that we experience playing, so obviously sport is like, it's so powerful. And if you don't play sport, it's really hard to recreate that. So, it's amazing what you're doing at the gym.
So it's like getting those people that might not have grown up playing sport. They might never have set foot in a gym. And we've got a lot of members that they're 50 years old, or their goal was, before I turn 50, I want to be able to get stronger and things, for mental health, for longevity, for all many reasons. Yeah. But it's then getting them in and getting them in that environment where they might not have ever experienced that team feel, and there's no better feeling in my eyes. Yeah.
Talking about members, you had a member on the news not too long ago.
Bobby.
What was his name?
Bobby.
Do you want to...
Are you talking about my famous break-in?
Yeah, do you want to just talk about that quickly?
Yeah. So actually, I've had a few media appearances lately.
That broke into clean.
Yeah. So, long story short, we had a break-in at the gym. His name was Bobby, so he tells us. He stayed over, so he broke in. It was a Sunday night. He broke into the gym. I believe he was homeless, I believe, because he was camping out in some back room in the building. There was a bed and a whole setup in there that he was sleeping in. And he managed to break into our gym. He stayed the night. He drank a lot of energy drinks. He cleaned up the bathroom. He cleaned up the gym, and amongst stealing all our stuff.
What did he steal? Like,
luckily, no equipment, supplements.
Yeah.
Merchandise, iPad, laptop, things that were sitting under the desk.
Oh, right. Okay.
So that was a setback to the start of 2024 that we probably didn't need financially at the gym.
Yeah.
But like, look, we got media attention. I was on the Today Show. So were you? You've got to see the light in the,
I just, in the
situation.
I saw it, and he was going into the bathrooms and rearranging everything and cleaning everything.
Yeah.
And then
how strange, right? He was an interesting fellow. And
obviously he got caught, did he?
Well, yes, he got caught by my trainer, Zeb. So Zeb walked in the next morning on Monday morning at 4:30 and found him cleaning the gym. And that's how we found out his name was Bobby, because he said, oh, hey, mate, are you meant to be here? He said, yeah, I'm Bobby, I'm the cleaner.
And what did Zeb go? Oh, right. Oh,
cool, nice to meet you.
Did he? And then he call you and go, oh, your cleaner's here.
I got there like 20 minutes later, and then he goes, oh, who's Bobby? Oh, do we have a new member? I thought we must have had a new member that arrived called Bobby. No, the cleaner. Mike said, we have not had a cleaner.
Yeah.
Who is this? He's like, oh, he's out the back. Anyway, yeah, he fled the scene and took a whole number of things, but...
fully energized.
The Bobby case, I don't know whether he's being caught or not, but he's out there somewhere.
It's a cold case.
It's a cold case. Still looking for Bobby.
So I've got five quick fire questions to finish.
Yes.
What are your three non-negotiables for living a healthy and full life?
So number one is my training and fitness and just living an active lifestyle. Every day I'll do some form of movement, and that is just so important for me to keep me sane mentally and physically, and I just love that. So that's number one. Number two is connection and family and relationships, and as we've touched on a lot, isolation and things like that is not good for anyone. So I just always encourage those relationships and making sure for me each week I have a checklist in what I do and how I touch base on my training as an athlete and just as a person. And one of those touch bases is connections. Have I spent time with family and friends, and have I taken the time to have those work on those relationships? Number one, fitness, obviously training every day. Number two, relationships. And number three, purpose and passion.
Nice.
I would say, because that's what keeps me going each day. Like, I'm a strong believer in having goals, and as I've touched on, I'm a very driven person. So I'm always have a goal, have a purpose, I have something that I'm working towards always, and that helps me in my everyday life mentally. And yeah, I think it helps other people. Reflecting on Dad, it's as soon as he lost his purpose, as soon as he lost what he thought his identity was and what he wanted to do in life, that's when he struggled. And so, yeah, it's just trying to find what that is and doing things that make you happy. And that, for me, that's the gym and building my community and all the other things that we've touched on. But for some people, that might just be doing things that make them happy.
Yeah.
And trying to search for, yeah, doing that.
What's your biggest fear?
The ocean.
Is it? Are you not a swimmer in the ocean?
Like, if you go in the depths of the ocean, what is down there? I don't know. And that scares me. But other than that,
I don't think there's much that scares you.
No, not much, yeah, to be honest.
Yeah.
Other than insects and moths and little things.
So there's a fair bit.
There's a fair bit of minute things. But yeah, yeah. In the world,
on the big scheme of things.
On the big scheme, yeah, of things, I'm not scared of much, and I think that comes down to having such a fortunate upbringing and having the support and backing from my parents to say, you know what, just go do whatever you want to do, and if you fail, then get back up again and dust yourself off and go again.
Go again.
I remember one time vividly when I got cut from a rep team. I didn't make this rep team for netball.
Yeah.
And I started crying after the selections and they name everyone. And my mum's like, what the hell? We get in the car and I start bawling. She's like, what the hell are you crying about? And I got no sympathy. And it was just like, Paris, don't be ridiculous. Like, you're going to fail. You're going to have these setbacks. Don't cry. Get back up. Go out there and work harder for next year. Set some goals. Do this and that. And I think that's just always been my mentality, is who cares? Like, yeah, cry about it. Well, you can cry, but then dust yourself off,
yeah, and go again.
And go again and, yeah, set your goals and, yeah, work harder. And yeah, so I think, yeah, don't be afraid to fail. You will fail and you'll learn from it. And I've learned a lot of things.
What? How have you defined success for you?
Well, right now, I would say happiness is the success, is success for me. Because I tell you what, I am not thriving financially. So it's not that. And I was like financially stable as a lawyer. And
that's the risk, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of going.
But I wasn't
happy.
Happy or like successful in my mind, because I was still searching for more to fulfill what I wanted to do. So that wasn't success. I do miss the income, but but I would say I'm much more successful now because I'm happy and I'm doing what I want to do. And yeah, whether that pays off financially or not, I don't know. And obviously there's only a certain amount of time you can do things that make you happy without having income. Without being Bobby. But
yeah,
success is happiness for me.
Yeah, love that. If you could go back to a time in your life, where would you go and why?
Back to when I was younger, when Dad was here.
Yeah. Thanks very much for coming on today. I've got a little closing tradition. So my closing tradition is that I don't ask the last question.
Okay.
This might make you cry a little bit more. So I get a loved one, whether it be a family member or a close friend, they send in questions for the guest. So we've got your partner.
Here we go.
Jackson sent a question in.
Cue the waterworks.
Hey Paris, what's one piece of advice you would give to someone struggling at the moment?
Good question, Jacko. So I guess coming from someone that's very much in the thick of their grief right now, and I would say I'm not struggling, but I'm being challenged and I'm going through my own challenges. And things that are helping me, I guess, navigate through this tough time is A, letting myself feel the emotions and having those tough days. Like last week, I just sat in the shower and sobbed and cried for an hour and a half. And I needed that. And I needed to just let it out. So don't be afraid to let your emotions out. Talk to people about those emotions. Like, it just makes you feel so much better when you talk to someone. And just let it all out. Another thing that's helping me is obviously finding something that keeps me occupied, that keeps me busy at the gym, running. Like, I'm doing a lot of events that I'm planning at the moment in the community and things like that, that keeps me busy and driven and focused. Yeah, talking to someone, feeling the emotions. You're going to have ups and downs. There's no doubt about it. So just let yourself go through it, but don't go through it alone. That's the number one. Don't go through it alone. If you need an hour to cry by yourself, do that, but then try and go out and message a friend, or if you're on the other end and you're a friend of someone that you know is struggling, just touch base with them, reach out, do things together. A big one for me is working out together or training together and doing things together. So it breaks that ice, but you're still spending time with them. You don't necessarily have to talk, but being in their presence, and there is the option for you to talk and be there. And if you're someone, just listen and make sure that you're touching base on people. For anyone, I guess, that is struggling mentally, obviously the big one is reach out to a medical professional, a psychologist, or anyone like that to seek further help. You can reach out to friends and lean on those, but the key would be obviously to seek that professional help. Yeah. And Lifeline and all of those things that are there are resources to help. But yeah, get out there and move your body, eat healthy, do things that are going to make you feel better about yourself and whatever that may be. That makes you feel better, make sure you do that. Spend time each week, a little bit of time for yourself. Even if you live a busy life, you work a lot, you still need to spend time doing those things, which is something that I'm really focusing on at the moment. Is as busy as my life may be, running the gym, trying to fit in my own trainings, footy trainings, like it's hectic, but you need to prioritize your own health mentally and physically. So you've got to prioritize time for me, to work out, to eat well, spend time with friends and family, and to spend time by myself doing whatever it is I need to do that week. Last week it was crying in the shower, listening to dad's playlists, looking through old photos, looking back on memories. If you're someone that has lost a parent or lost a loved one and is grieving, thinking back on those happy memories has helped me significantly. Whilst it is sad and you'll cry, think of the good times, and it's something to hold on to, and it makes you feel so much better, and just let those emotions out. That's what I've been doing.
Yeah. Thanks very much for coming on today. Like I said, I really appreciate it and I really admire you, so
thank you for having me.
That's all right.
Sorry for the tears.
Don't be sorry.
But it's all about the process.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Don't ever be sorry.
But yes, thank you. My first podcast. I enjoyed it.
Nice.
It was, great to chat, and I feel super comfortable with you and opening and sharing my story. So thank you for being so...
I appreciate that.
Lovely, welcoming, and letting me be vulnerable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers, Paris.